The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon. Welcome, everybody, to the Sunday Space Show. I am your host, David Livingston. It's great to be here on a really cool, beautiful day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it's equally as nice. So, again, great to welcome you to the show. Let's run through the announcements, and then we're off to our program, which I promise you will be exciting, informative, cutting edge, and maybe some of you might even get some buttons pushed. We'll see. First of all, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let it ring until we can answer it. Be patient, and I'll bring you up on the air as quickly as possible. And then email drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. And chat is on IM, ICQ, or CompuServe. The screen name is the same for all of these services. One word, lowercase, Space Show Chat. It is visible and working now. You should have no problems getting through to us on chat. Remember, we are trademarked and copyrighted, but you do have permission to download shows and put them on memory sticks, DVDs, send them around and circulate the programs. Please don't do anything to change the text of any of the interviews and nothing commercial with the programs. As always, we thank Andrew and Gigadial.net. They do our podcasting for us. The RSS subscription URL is on our website, both newsletters. We're iTunes compatible. Search for The Space Show or my name. We're also in Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com in South America, and a host of other locations. If you have any trouble with our podcast, please do let me hear from you. Our website is thespaceshow.com. And on it, you'll find a comprehensive, detailed newsletter. And that goes up Sunday night or Monday morning. All of the details of the shows are there, the guest bios. And we also have a future events section. But as I always say, if we have to change or add programming to the schedule, this is where you'll see it first. By the way, pay attention this week. We have an added program Thursday morning, 9:30 California time. Gwen Shotwell, president of SpaceX, is on for 1 hour only, and that, again, is Thursday morning. Everything we do is archived, and you can download the shows or listen to them right from our website. We have a store on our website. Look for the button at the top that says Space Show Gear. And then remember, we are a nonprofit, 501c3, with the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. You'll see the Support the Space Show button up at the top. Again, we can't do this program without your financial support and your giving to us, and we really appreciate those of you that have supported us and continue to do so. If you pay U.S. taxes, and only 50% of Americans do pay U.S. taxes anymore, remember you do get a tax donation for your contribution. So we thank you very much for your support and your continued support. Please also remember the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, please visit secureworldfoundation.org. And then in place of hold the dates, remember I'm telling you about the Churchill Club program in Palo Alto, California, Wednesday, April 21st. If any of you are in the Bay Area or the Palo Alto region and you want to attend, the Churchill Club is having a space commercialization panel with Peter Diamandis, Naveen Jain, Bob Richards, an astronaut, and I am moderating this panel again at 7 to 8:30 at the Crown Plaza Hotel. Tickets are $75, but if you write me for instructions, I have a few tickets left to give away, and you can get in for free. So send your request to me, and I'll tell you how to get the free tickets. And again, that's Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, April 21st, 7 to 8:30 p.m., Palo Alto, California. So please do check that out. So let me tell you about our show today. We're honored to bring back to the show after a couple of years. It's been a while. Mark Whittington, and Mark is with us. He's the author of Children of Apollo, The Last Moonwalker, and other stories. He writes frequently on space issues at the Houston Space Examiner, and as well as associated content. And he blogs on a variety of issues, including space, at Curmudgeon's Corner. And he was last with us a couple of years ago, and it's really an honor to bring Mark back for this program. And Mark, welcome back to the Space Show. How you been these years?
Oh, I've been very well, David. Whatever shall we talk about?
Well, let's see. I think just a few people keep talking about space policy and what happened. I think there was some little meeting at the Cape, right, the other day or something like that. Why don't you give us the origins of how we got to the administration's proposals for a new space policy?
Well, President Obama's space policy, if you can call it that, has had more twists and turns than anything I've ever seen. We can first start around November, December of 2007, when Obama, then Senator Obama, put out his part of a proposal for an education scheme that he would delay the onset of the Constellation program by 5 years in order to pay for it. It basically, at that point, the so-called space gap between the retirement of the space shuttle and the planned introduction of the Orion spacecraft was 5 years, and he would have extended it another 5 years. Well, after people started pointing out that this was kind of untenable because this would mean that we would spend 10 years being reliant on other people, you know, like the Russians, for space travel, the Obama campaign came back and said, well, we're only proposing that the space exploration portion of Constellation would be delayed 5 years. And then, you know, we still try to build the low Earth orbit version of Orion, you know, on time and so on. Then, in August of 2008, after then-Senator Obama, candidate Obama, had clinched the nomination for president, he went down to Titusville in Florida. He gave a big rousing speech there in front of a lot of aerospace workers in which he promised that he would ensure that the Constellation program would proceed on time and on budget under his administration, and that we would, you know, be on the moon by 2020. President Obama was elected president. He had won Florida. And then later on, he formed the Augustine Committee to examine the space exploration program and come up with recommendations. And the Augustine Committee came back with an analysis of the Constellation program, in which they said basically that there was a mismatch between what the program planned and how it was being funded. Now, a lot of people will take out of context the phrase that they used, that the program was unsustainable. But what they say in reality is that the program was unsustainable under the current budget profile. You know, implication was, of course, if you were to fund it adequately, you could bring the program back into sustainability. Well, then President Obama mulled over this, and then, surprise, surprise, on February the 1st, he announced his 2011 budget, and under the NASA budget, the Constellation program would be completely canceled. Aside from that, there were some good things. He initiated a commercial space initiative in which we would enable and subsidize and buy commercial space travel from some of the nascent commercial space companies to access the International Space Station. International Space Station was also extended at least until 2020. And there was proposed a technological research and development program. Nothing that would really lead to any concrete missions, but kind of neat sort of things, building new space propulsion systems, on-orbit refueling, just a whole lot of stuff that could be very useful when you send missions past low Earth orbit. Well, this particular proposal was greeted by the Congress and the public, you know, very negatively. You know, I think we've all seen the spectacles of poor Charles Bolden being trotted up the Capitol Hill and getting a lot of very angry and uncomfortable questions about why we were abandoning space exploration, which essentially, in my opinion, is what we were, because there was no deadline, no destination, and certainly no timetable in which to get there. Well, then about a week ago, the White House announced that, well, all right, we're going to kind of sort of bring back the idea of a heavy lift launcher, which a lot of people believe is necessary to do expeditions beyond low Earth orbit. And the Orion space capsule is coming back, but only as an escape pod for the International Space Station. Now, yeah, I'm not sure why we would need an extra escape pod. I think the Soyuz spacecraft are docked there, working quite well for that purpose. Then, Thursday, President Obama came down to the scene of the crime, as it were, the Kennedy Space Center. There's also a fun story about the Orion mock-up that they had at his speech venue. Before, when, you know, the Orion project was out, NASA was instructed to just take out anything that even smacked of Orion from the room. Then suddenly Orion was back into favor again, and NASA had to scramble to put the Orion mock-up back to make a good, pretty backdrop. Well, anyway, President Obama made his speech, and he added a few things. This is Obama 3.0 or Obama 5.0, depending upon what you're counting, that said that, all right, the Orion's escape pod will eventually evolve into Orion proper, a deep spaceship. And we would research and develop ideas for a heavy lift launcher with a decision of the design and a go-ahead to start building it no later than 2015. We would have shakedown cruises of our deep spaceship sometime in the early 2020s. We'd go to an asteroid in 2025, Mars orbit in 2035, and then landing on Mars sometime later, but President Obama expects to live to see it. So it should be in the lifetime of a person who is rumored to still be a smoker. So that is essentially, in short, the evolution of what I call Obama space, the Obama space policy. And I'm pretty sure it's still a work in progress, because I don't think that the Obama speech in Florida has been received any better than anything else that he's done since February the 1st.
Why would there be opposition to this policy, given the delays and cost overruns with Constellation and the fact that we're constantly reminded of problems with Ares 1, although I don't buy into that, although I'm not a rocket engineer?
Well, Norm Augustine himself said, and it's also in the Augustine report, that the problems of Ares 1 and Orion and so on are normal for new spacecraft rocket development programs. These always happen. A lot of the commercial space firms like SpaceX have had similar problems, and they work through it, and that's why you hire all these engineers, because, you know, rocket science is a synonym for something that is hard for a reason. Now, as far as the cost overruns, I think this is kind of a doublethink on the part of at least the congressional critics, because on the one hand, they're kind of complicit in underfunding the Constellation program. You know, I know that the Bush administration really didn't, you know, propose adequate funding, but of course the power of the purse is with Congress. You know, so they've been underfunding Constellation. The cost overruns have gone on. The schedule keeps slipping further and further to the right. And then all of a sudden, Obama has canceled the program. And, well, now they're outraged. But I would tell any member of Congress this, that you should really start thinking about the idea that maybe you help cause this by undercutting the Constellation program by not funding it properly.
Well, that won't register. Look, they don't even think they caused any of the banking or the home mortgage or any of those issues.
Well, I'm sure that in the heart of hearts or in private over a few drinks, they probably do. But, no, they will never acknowledge that publicly.
On the surface of it, at least, I mean, as I say to people, my foreign mail is almost 100% opposed to Obama space. My domestic email, especially coming in from space advocates, space enthusiasts, Space Frontier Foundation, and other organizations, is overwhelmingly supportive of President Obama's plan, even if they don't like the president on 100% of the rest of his policy and issues. They somehow are really, you know, adhered to and really support and love his space plan. Where are the risks? I mean, going commercial to LEO seems like it should be something we should be striving for and working to bring into place.
Yeah, I in fact like the commercial space aspect of Obama space up to a point. My concern is that as it is now, the commercial space initiative that would basically develop these commercial spacecraft and then lease rides on them could set up a situation in which these new commercial space lines, as it were, would only have the government as their sole customer and would be heavily subsidized by the government. And those would be very susceptible to having to follow government rules and regulations. The problem with the commercial space initiative is that the administration hasn't done really anything to help enable and foster private markets. Now, I know that Bigelow Aerospace has their private space station thing, and, you know, I have high hopes that that will come into being and that would be a private market, and maybe SpaceX and other companies will take paying customers, rich people, on little jaunts around low Earth orbit, you know, for tens of millions of dollars, and they can make a little bit of money that way. But the administration could do a lot more to help out the growth of private markets. My suggestion would be an excellent idea that Congressman Dana Rohrabacher had a few years ago, which he termed zero gravity, zero taxes, which would make space an enterprise zone. Goods and services created in space, and I would assume that things like GPS and CommSats would be exempt from this since they already exist, would not be taxed for a number of years. You know, they would be streamlined regulations and so on. But, of course, we're living under a liberal democratic administration, a liberal democratic Congress, and they don't do tax cuts. Another idea might be that if anybody puts up a private space station, NASA would buy time on them. It would supplement the International Space Station quite nicely because, believe me, I would suspect that there's more stuff that people would want to do than the International Space Station would be able to accommodate, you know, even if it lasted for many decades. And, you know, I mean, that's basically my opinion on the commercial space aspect of things. And also, I think that going all in on commercial space, basically getting rid of the public option, which is Ares 1 and Orion, may be sound, but they need to be prepared for the unexpected. Commercial space is not unsusceptible to technical glitches, funding shortfalls, unexpected things that can delay stuff. And the government may need to have to pour more money in that in order to cover it. And they need to be prepared for that eventuality.
Let me give you your first question, which is Bob in Toledo. And he says, what role is it of the government to foster and develop private markets anyway? If this is commercial, shouldn't the commercial markets develop markets? And if there aren't markets, then why do the business? That's the way everything else works in commercial everything.
Well, not exactly. I mean, the government is involved quite a bit in private business. I mean, under a perfect, I suppose, libertarian society in which the government doesn't do much of anything besides national defense and running the courts, that would be true. But governments subsidize a lot of things with tax breaks for oil companies, for instance, running the air traffic control system. You know, the list is endless. So one of the reasons why the government would want to foster private markets for space industries is that if we're going to go commercial, at least for from Earth to low Earth orbit, having private markets that these commercial space transportation companies can have would lower the cost of, you know, the government leasing of these particular space flights, because they would, because of course these companies would be flying all sorts of vehicles to other destinations in low Earth orbit, private space stations. Maybe somebody will revive the idea of a man-tended industrial space facility. That was an idea from the late 80s that never came to be for various political reasons. But it's kind of a win-win situation, at least the way I see it.
Do you think that for the general public, that any of this... Well, let me do it this way. Did you see the new poll that came out? I mean, I started getting it on Friday about what Americans think of space in general. I don't know if you've seen this or not.
Conducted by which organization?
Everett.
I have not seen that one. I've seen the latest Rasmussen, which looked like it was an improvement over the one that they did, I think, back in December or January. But anyway, what did Everett have
to
say?
I mean, all of the issues that we in the space, and I'm going to discuss this at length on my open line show Tuesday night, but all of the issues that we in the space cadet community are debating and getting our feathers ruffled over and working on don't even register. I mean, nothing. So something like 51% of the people think space is important because they want to protect it from getting hit by an asteroid. 48% say we should protect, we should use NASA to do Earth imaging and learn more about the climate to protect the environmental system of the Earth. And then after that, everything is minor potatoes. And this stuff about going to the moon or exploration or constellation or this, I mean, it doesn't even show up. It's zero, zilch, nada, nothing. And they surveyed 1,250 people by telephone up to the point of Obama's speech, but the survey does not go to the point of his speech on Thursday or beyond that.
So, well, I, of course, don't know what the sampling was or, you know, what the exact wording of the question is, because, as you probably know, in polling, you can get the results you want to depending upon how you ask the questions and what sequence.
Well, they listed them. You can see them all.
There's a lot of ignorance on the part of the general public about space issues.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe a little less now because it's been discussed a lot in the media.
Wow, wait a minute. Something like only 22% of the people knew that Obama had proposed a new space policy.
And that's probably, you know, twice the amount of people who was even aware of space policy before the Obama announcement.
So, you know, in a sense, we're having the debate among ourselves, you know, the space community, you know, within ourselves. But I guess, you know, my point of even bringing this up is, do we even have to register any of this with the general public? Or is this really an issue of going after Congress, which, as you said earlier, appropriates the bucks for NASA and really will decide whether the president gets all or most of his policy recommendations, or Congress tries to manage space policy?
Well, probably, in my opinion, a little of both. I mean, yes, space policy does tend to be a little bit of inside baseball because it's a little bit esoteric for some people. You know, people might be aware that we're launching space shuttles and whatnot, but it's not... next, for instance, debates over health care reform and cap and trade and the stimulus package and unemployment, it doesn't register. And, you know, I don't really have a good answer as far as how one could educate the public on space issues, because that would be a very hard, a big job for somebody who's high profile. A president of the United States surely could, but I don't think this president is very interested in having an informed public. You know, otherwise they might think that his particular approach to space exploration and other space issues are not really the right ones to go.
Here's a question. We'll do this one before the break. Marshall in Dallas said, I watched the president on television. He said something about, and I'm quoting, no one was more pro-man space than I, end quote. What really burned me was that the statement was followed by lots of cheering in the room. I'm just curious to know if you think that audience was hand-picked supporters and controlled. Do they hold up applause signs?
I don't know if they hold up applause signs, but they were definitely hand-picked.
Yeah, I know that for a fact because of the efforts I made to try to get Jim Lewis, my Cape Canaveral space shuttle representative, who does lots and lots of media for space and NASA and press, into that thing, and we could not get into the VIP list. So
I know. Definitely did not want contact with the common, ordinary Kennedy Space Center workforce, because he didn't want to have a YouTube moment with somebody jumping up and yelling, you lie, like what happened in the State of the Union address in 2009.
No, and I recognized a lot of my friends who are very supportive of the Obama policy. They were there, and I know others that sent me emails saying they had gotten invitations, and they were very vocally and overtly supportive of the program. So I fully understand that. And so be it. But, I mean, they did broadcast it live, and, you know, all the subsequent programs were made available, and people can make up their own mind.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess I could say, what's wrong with all this? What should we be doing? I know, like, for example, on the space show, ever since Bush announced the VSE, we've been saying, look, you know, it's dead on arrival. It's never going to get funded through different presidential administrations. I mean, we didn't even have a dream of any administration like this one. So that had nothing to do with Obama coming into office. I love my friends at ATK. I think Ares 1 is a much maligned rocket. I think people calling it the worst rocket ever made and it'll kill people and all this are totally out in fantasy and la-la land with a lot of undeserved hatred. Yet, you know, $1 billion for a ride to the moon when we're not even clarifying why we're going to the moon and on. I mean, nobody in their right mind would think these programs are really going to be funded through to fruition. So what should we be doing with NASA and space policy?
Well, I don't know exactly what we mean by we. I mean,
the United States, our country.
Let's just say, first of all, I could have wished that President Bush had rolled out Constellation in the first year of his administration. I know that he had quite a few other problems. There was this minor little thing that happened on 9/11, but the idea is that, yes, it's very hard to sustain a long-term space program over several administrations. Now, the space station is obviously an example of one that succeeded with a few near-death experiences. First proposed by Reagan, then George Herbert Walker Bush, Clinton, George Walker Bush, and now President Obama. I think the idea is to try to structure these kind of programs that would have milestones that would happen within the administration of the person proposing it, and to get them up and running to such an extent and maybe get some successes accomplished so that the next administration would not have an incentive to suddenly cancel it.
Well, that didn't happen, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, no. I mean, we went through the whole business of it being underfunded, and also a lot of the Internet criticism wasn't really answered, I think, very adequately. And then it was picked up by the media. The Orlando Sentinel, for instance, seemed to have a very big problem with the entire program.
Go ahead. I was going to give you another question from a listener.
Sure.
And then we'll take a break. Sally is in Ogden, Utah, and Sally says, I read on a lot of the space blogs that there is concern that the commercial companies cannot provide adequate safety for launching humans to the space station, nor can they do it in any kind of reasonable time frame. Do you have any thoughts on any of that?
Well, that again is something you know you really can't answer. Space expertise is and engineering is the same whether it's in the private sector or in NASA. And you know, I just have to say as an answer to that, we lost two space shuttles under the NASA program, seven people each killed. And we had to spend a lot of money to quote make things safe. Now, I think that with adequate and with sensible engineering and with a willingness to spend a little money, probably more than what we think, we can have a fairly safe commercial space enterprise.
Do you think putting all the eggs in one basket to go commercial in what I say is a cold turkey transition, kind of all or nothing, is that the way to go?
Well, every space architecture has its advantages and disadvantages. Going all in with commercial means you don't have to build the Ares 1 rocket, which means that if you have a sensible space exploration program, you can start directly doing your Lunar and Beyond program. I know that the Augustine Committee had several scenarios in which you would basically have a lighter version of the Ares 5 in various configurations, and you would not have to have two different rockets. You know, you would have one Ares 5 would launch the Orion, another Ares 5 would launch the Lunar Lander, for instance. They would both dock at some point and go on to the moon. Now, on the other hand, you know, you're right. You know, you don't have a backdrop just in case that the commercial space sector doesn't step up or runs into problems and delays. Now, on the other hand, of course, NASA programs have had problems and delays, so there's really no easy answer.
Let's take our break. And one of the things that bothers me a lot, I talk about on the air, and of course I didn't hear the president address this in his talk at all, and you know I still don't see enough about it to satisfy my views, and that is the gap and having to be reliant upon the Russians, but let's hit that when we come back. That to me is a huge issue because of foreign policy and national security. Listeners, stay where you are. Back with Mark Whittington in about 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Sunday Space Show. Our guest today, Mark Whittington. Mark, let's continue with your analysis on the rationale for Obama space. And I think my question before the break and some others will be answered in the process of your explanation and discussion.
Well, I think contrary to what the president said in Florida last Thursday, I don't think he really likes the idea of space exploration at all. I think these proposals I rolled out kind of at the last minute, you know, asteroid by 2025, Mars orbit by 2035, and so on, are ruses. I mean, to be blunt, I mean, I hate to be the one who's standing up in the hall and yelling, "You lied," to the president, but I guess I am. He really does not really envision these things as actually going to be happening. Somebody who would be really interested in space exploration as something that would enhance the United States' national security, its economic vitality, and so on, would have said something, you know, similar to what John F. Kennedy said: "We're going back to the moon within this decade." And he would add, and we're going to stay. The idea of bypassing the moon, I mean, just because Buzz Aldrin was there once 41 years ago, strikes me as crazy, particularly since the recent discoveries by space probe from India, the LaCrosse, that there seems to be water in relative abundance. Water really enables the idea that we could go to the moon and live and use that as a jumping off point to explore the solar system. A lot of people I know, for instance, tout the idea of in-orbit refueling stations to enhance deep space program travel. Well, you can use water to make rocket fuel. And the lunar's gravitational well is a little bit less, so you can shoot that up to wherever you want your fuel depot to be. And, you know, that would enhance things. But President Obama is advocating is, you know, aside from the shakedown cruises he mentioned in the early 2020s, is exactly three voyages of exploration taking place over more than 20 years. By contrast, Apollo did six successful voyages to the moon in just over 3 years. Constellation was imagining, at least for a start, two voyages to the moon each year. I guess until, you know, sometime in the 2020s, we would build a lunar base and then start using that. I think that if you really research, particularly the attitudes of the president himself and some of his advisors like John Holdren, they regard space exploration as a manifestation of American exceptionalism, which they don't like. America is the only country to have landed men on the moon so far. We are still, I mean, despite everything, the preeminent space power. And that, for them, is a bug, not a feature, in how the United States should be. They regard the idea that if we're ahead in something, this would create some kind of overweening ambition and arrogance that would make us kind of a not liked very well in the international community. If they regarded space exploration as a thing to be valued at all, it's something to be done collectively with other countries. And the way they imagine that is that we don't really surge ahead and become a leader. We're just kind of one among many. You know, hence, you know, we're not going to go, you know, rushing out anytime soon to explore the moon or even an asteroid or Mars.
You know, if in the absence of getting emails or calls from my friends who are really genuinely supportive of the administration's policy, and I really wish they would call or they would email in. Let me be the devil's advocate and see if I can pose a question or two to you.
Sure.
That I think would be from their perspective. And number one, they're going to cite the budget, that we really, as a country, the economic woes are unbelievable. And as Augustine pointed out, we don't have the money to do everything. And so where do we start cutting? And number two, flexible path seems to offer, you know, the best options for how to design a space program for the future. The moon doesn't seem to be where the action is. The real goal is to ultimately get to Mars, even if we do a NEO in between. We need much needed new technologies. We certainly need new propulsion systems that are far better than chemical rockets. Everybody, you know, probably on the planet is agreement that chemical rockets are way too costly, and we need to find other technologies and ways around that. If that's possible to do, we need to lower the cost of space access, which commercial space can definitely do, especially if they're handling transportation to LEO. And we're not equipped to do deep space missions and explorations now, and we need to develop and perfect those technologies to be able to allow us to leapfrog and make the quantum leaps ahead that we all want for our space program to be spacefaring. So I've kind of slurred all these issues together, but I'm sure you've heard them all before. How do you respond to that? Because they don't see anything negative out of what's being proposed. They see a complete opening to a much leaner, more efficient, more effective NASA that, you know, does things like the old NACA, where the technologies are finally created to take us forward, where we finally get cost-effective space transportation, at least to LEO. NASA gets out of the business of designing rockets and instead buying the ride. Where are we going wrong here? I mean, these are things that many of us have advocated and fought for decades.
Okay. First of all, the budget. NASA spending is not driving the budget deficit.
You can say that again.
In real terms, NASA's budget has been kind of flat for the last 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. And if we were to increase NASA's budget from the half penny they were spending on it now to 0.6, 0.7, or even a penny of every federal dollar, not going to affect the budget deficit one way or the other. The budget deficit is being driven primarily by entitlements. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare, the new one.
And my
answer is, if you want to address the budget deficit, you need to address entitlements, not NASA. I'm sure there's lots of other discretionary spending we ought not to be doing, but I really think that NASA, and I will recognize NASA as a government agency, probably wastes more money than it should. But I think that that's a function of leadership and fiscal discipline. Now, as for the other thing, I agree with the technological R&D program up to a point. My concern is that it's unfocused. It's not pointed towards anything. Let's take, for instance, voyages to Mars. Yes, I think Charles Bolden is quite right, that we need to do two things in order to get to Mars in any kind of reasonable way. First, of course, is a non-chemical propulsion system, nuclear thermal, something like Ching Dai's Basmer drive, something else. And also proper radiation shielding, and also some way to ameliorate the long-term effects of microgravity. But if you're going to do that, it should lead to a definite expedition to Mars at some specific point in time. Not, you know, well, we're going to do Mars sometime in the far future, you know, indeterminate, you know, sometime in, you know, the 2040s or thereabouts. The moon, which is my particularly favorite first destination out to the solar system. you probably don't need a lot of good gee whiz technology to get back to the moon. You could do the moon using off-the-shelf technology that we have today. However, getting to the moon more effectively and cheaper might involve some technological development. But that could be done in conjunction with a lunar exploration program. Also, living on the moon is going to require some technological development. In situ resource utilization, extracting the water from the deep craters, cracking oxygen out of lunar regolith, lunar agriculture, recycling technology. But, of course, you have to be on the moon, really, to test and develop those technologies adequately. So, you know, in summary, my particular idea is that you do the technology, but it's tied to an actual...
Okay.
Okay, now, the commercial thing, you know, I've said before, I like the commercial thing. I think, though, that it doesn't go far enough, that we need to help develop private markets so that SpaceX and Orbital and any other company that jumps in is not totally tied to the space station and to servicing government contracts. They need to be also flying to other places, you know, doing true commercial space travel.
So how do they develop or help create these markets, and what are they?
Well, as far as that is concerned, something like Bigelow's private space station. Obviously, for that to work, you need to have a way to get there and to get home. And it kind of makes me itchy that Bigelow is really the only major company that's anywhere near having that particular dream realized. As I also mentioned before, a program of tax cuts and regulatory relaxations that basically make space into an enterprise zone should help out as well. Buying the services on private space stations, but only, of course, if they actually exist, should also be a way to try to jumpstart things. The thing is, you cannot guarantee that any one company is going to succeed. You know, anything in which you say that company X, you know, in 5 years we're going to be flying people into space or doing this, that, or the other thing is what they call in the investment community forward-looking statements. But if you have a environment in which this sort of thing is encouraged, and a lot of particular entrepreneurial companies are working towards that goal, a handful are going to succeed, though a lot of them are going to fail.
By the way, do you think value-added tax will be tacked on to the price of a suborbital tourism ticket?
If it passes, I can guarantee it.
So value-added tax on a $200,000-plus item, what would that be? I have no clue.
Well, it all depends. I mean, I suspect that, you know, if they actually try to push it through and they succeed, I really doubt that they will succeed. But let's say they do, they'll probably have something like, at the start, a 5% VAT tax. And, you know, 5% of $200,000 is, what, $1,000?
No, $10,000.
$10,000, you're right.
STEM education,
point.
Listeners.
But, of course, the experience of European countries is that the rate of value-added taxes just keeps being ratcheted up.
Yeah, it's pretty disgusting.
You know, they start with 5, 6, 7%.
And it's hidden.
Now they're about 20% in most European countries.
Yeah, and it's hidden. You can't really see it. So
no, you see, that's the beauty of a value-added tax is that it's hidden and people can't complain. Now, I would even, you know, this is kind of off the space topic, even be kind of in favor of a value-added tax if in exchange we got rid of the income tax. And that would include repealing the constitutional amendment that committed it.
Well, that's not going to happen.
So they couldn't bring it back at some point.
Are you kidding? They're going to keep them both? Are you?
Well, of course they want to keep them both.
They're not going to repeal any taxes, not with these deficits. Here, I got questions mounting up that listeners want their turn to question you rather than just listening to me. So,
sure.
Okay, Marshall gets the first one. His came in first, and he's sitting here patiently in Dallas on Instant Messenger, and he says, April 12th, Aviation Week. Page 18, reports that NASA is contracting for at least six rides to the space station from the Russians for 55.8 million buckaroos. By my calculation, that price is about the cost of a shuttle mission. I don't know how he configures that for a shuttle mission. It's about $1 billion.
Shuttle mission's about $500 million, give or take.
Give or could be up to $1 billion, depending on what it's taking.
Like I said,
yeah.
Give or take.
So, Marshall, I don't know. The cost of an astronaut on the shuttle is a couple of $100 million, again, depending on the cargo and what's in there. So, STEM education, Marshall. We need more space to inspire
to give Marshall a little slack.
Yeah, he knows.
I suspected that when the shovel is retired, that price is going to go up a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the Russian Soyuz would have a monopoly. You know, we have to have people on the space station, and the Russians know it, and we know it, and we'll pay whatever they ask.
Well, that gets into my question, and forgive me, listeners, because I know your questions are mounting up. And this is the most troubling part of all of this to me, and actually Constellation doesn't solve this problem. Only the shuttle solves it, and that is the gap and being dependent for 7, 8, 9, 10 years, maybe more, on the Russians to do this. I think it is a loss of our sovereignty. It is a damage and a potential threat to our national security to be so dependent upon the Russians to get to what is basically our interest in the space station and more. And yet the shuttle is the only way to buy down that gap, and that's not being extended. And I'm deeply disturbed about that gap. Am I overplaying it?
Well, the gap is very troubling. Now, of course, the decision to end the space shuttle program by this year was undertaken by the Bush administration. Now, of course, to be fair to them, at that time, Orion was going to start flying in 2012, 2013. But again, you know, because of various factors, including the underfunding, the first liftoff date, planned liftoff date for the Orion kept getting pushed back, and the gap kept increasing. So, yeah, I mean, I know that there are some members of Congress who are trying to extend the shuttle program, you know, maybe two flights a year just so that the Russians wouldn't have a monopoly. That will probably be horrendously expensive. And, you know, if you ask me, I would probably rather, if you're going to spend that amount of money, spend that amount of money getting the commercial people up and running sooner. Maybe doing a Orion Ares 1 public option, though, like I said, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages to doing that versus going all in on commercial and then, you know, going directly to de-space exploration.
What about foreign policy, national security issues outside the space community? Is being dependent upon the Russians, am I overblowing that risk?
It is a very bad risk. The Russians, particularly under Mr. Putin, are being very aggressive. I mean, they invaded Georgia a little while ago. I mean, in the ordinary, you know, circumstance, you know, that sort of thing would have put a big chill on Russian-American relations. But, you know, we're not going to pull out of the space station program just because the Russians knocked over another country. What if they invade the Ukraine? Ukraine is, you know, they're very interested in extending their influence over the countries that used to comprise the old Soviet Union. There's no easy answer for that. We're kind of stuck right now. We can do things that can try to alleviate it. It will cost money. The Obama administration doesn't seem to be interested in spending more up to a certain point. You know, they tout, you know, we're going to spend $6 billion over the next 5 years to do all this neat stuff we're planning to do. I think that's inadequate. I mean, to be honest with you, people talk about budget realities as if it was some kind of law of physics. Budget realities is just a function of the decisions people make prioritizing things.
Well, also this 6-year total or 5-year total is all rhetoric and fantasy. Congress funds for 1 year at a time, and there's no assurance that the president would even propose $6 billion in the fiscal 12 or 13 budget.
That's correct.
So it's la-la land.
The Bush administration told Mike Griffin, this is the budget you're going to get for Orion, which is apparently adequate, and then they just reneged.
I mean, yeah, so this is not signed, sealed, and delivered in blood, people. This is just la-la land rhetoric and fantasy to sell the program. Marshall wanted to know, and we got off on the cost of the shuttle, but his real punchline question was, are we outsourcing exporting jobs to Russia from NASA by, you know, going with Soyuz? And I guess we are.
Yeah, I mean, the shuttle workforce is going away. I mean, some of them may be working on whatever projects they'll be working on. Some might be picked up by new commercial firms. But, you know, shuttle's going away, Constellation's basically going away. Yeah, I mean, we're going to put out thousands of very skilled engineers and technicians who have been trained to solve some of the most difficult problems in the world out on the street. And you know, I understand that a lot of people have this kind of disdain for NASA managers and NASA bureaucrats. And, you know, I sympathize with that, and I've kind of, you know, been on that myself. But there are a lot of worker bees. You know, people who have helped bend metal and help keep things going, who aren't going to be there anymore, and their expertise is going out the door.
And we'll be buying this expertise from the Russians while this gap continues.
Yeah.
John Hunt in Atlanta sent in an email that says, don't you think the saving for the Orion as a lifeboat plus congressional opposition will ultimately lead to an Orion light launched by an EELV? It makes no sense to spend that kind of money for a CRV, which is a crew return vehicle, listeners.
Well, that kind of goes into dueling engineers. You know, I know about the ELV, the idea of launching things on ELV or an ELV-derived vehicle. The people who defend the Ares One says that, no, you really can't do that cost-effectively and still run it in the amount of safety that we want to do. You know, the Ares One is the way to go. The ELV people are saying, no, you know, the Ares One is technically flawed and horrendously expensive and this, that, and the other thing. And it's really just who you want to believe. And, of course, there are people who have other ideas. There's the direct idea that's been percolating around for the past 3 or 4 years that looks kind of interesting. But, you know, and I don't really know what's going to really emerge from the Congressional Sausage Factory, because I don't think it's going to be exactly Obama Space 3.0. But failing something that I see, failing something that I don't foresee happening, it's not going to be a restoration or revival of Constellation either. You know, like I said, that would involve spending a lot more money. And without, you know, presidential support, I mean real presidential support, bringing in congressional leaders and lobbying them intensely, I don't think that can happen. It may just be something that we're going to have to muddle through until the next president shows up, and hopefully he or she will be able to fix things, and hopefully within the first year of his or her administration.
Let me give you this question from Kelly. He says, I agree with you about Obama and his group's dislikes for American exceptionalism. But as to commercial space, I think more attention needs to be given to who is really commercial. Less than a tenth of the staffs involved with launches now are NASA employees, commercial contractors from Boeing and Lockheed for the most part. Design, build, and service and launch the shuttles, train the crews, plan the missions, and staff mission control. Two shuttle losses were traced to orders from NASA managers overriding commercial concerns. So I don't see where NASA involvement is critical or even necessarily helpful. On the other hand, that's a good argument to contract commercial crew transport to Boeing or Lockheed Martin. Do you think the NASA versus commercial argument is a specious argument. Do you think Boeing and Lockheed really have an inside track on winning any commercial crew contracts?
Well, I know that, for instance, that Boeing has kind of a nascent commercial space plan with Bigelow, you know, trying to build something that would launch on a Delta IV or an Atlas V to service their planned commercial private space station. Of course, a lot of the problems with big aerospace is that they don't really think entrepreneurially. Boeing, for instance, is the only company now in the United States that builds airliners, and that's their big commercial thing. Most of what other things Boeing does is servicing government contracts, defense, NASA, and so on. Same for Lockmart, except Lockmart doesn't do big commercial airliners. So it would take kind of a sea change in attitude for either one of these companies to do that. Now, of course, they develop this kind of shell company, United Space Alliance, that supposedly runs the shuttle. It runs the shuttle, of course, under NASA direction. There were some proposals back in the 80s to do a commercial shuttle, to even build an orbiter that would do commercial space flights. NASA opposition and the fact that it's really horrendously expensive to turn around a shuttle orbiter kind of scotched that idea. Now, whether they can do something in the future, I don't know. I mean, companies reinvent themselves sometimes. Look at IBM, for instance. They used to be the big mainframe computer giant of all time back in the 60s and 70s. They've now kind of changed themselves into a computer servicing company. Companies can change with the times. So, you know, that's something that may be possible. I don't know. My crystal ball is kind of cloudy there.
What do you think will happen with SpaceX and Orbital?
I think SpaceX has a good chance. They have actually launched things. They've had two successful launches with their Falcon 1. They have worked through a lot of the technical problems with doing launch vehicles. Orbital, maybe. I mean, Orbital has been doing launch vehicles for quite a while. So, yeah, I think both of them have a more than even chance of making something happen. But, you know, the history of commercial space is replete with companies that have grown and blossomed and then kind of fallen by the wayside.
What about Sierra Nevada with, you know, the old Space Dev and their version on an Atlas?
Don't know. Like I said, you know, there are all sorts of people with all sorts of interesting plans. Depends on markets, depends on financing, depends on their ability then to build technical challenges. I really couldn't tell you company by company with any degree of accuracy who's more likely to succeed or fail, except, you know, from people like Orbital and SpaceX that have already gotten a track record.
Hold it there, and we'll take our next break for 2 minutes. And listeners, stay right where you are. When you come back, remember the toll-free line is available, 1-866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And we are back, listeners. Our guest today, Mark Whittington. Again, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And also, we will keep the show open to the top of the hour, so that's roughly 45 or so more minutes. Mark, on your blog, which is associatedcontent.com, you have you have copied an article from an MIT source with a person named Yost.
Keith Yost,
that says the true purpose of the Obama administration policy, and thank God the wraps are off of it. So why don't you let the who is Yost? Does he speak with any authority, and what is he saying?
He's some kind of correspondent for a newsletter that's put out by MIT. I'm not sure what his exact academic qualifications are or experience in, but essentially he gives kind of the traditional left-wing liberal response to why we shouldn't actually explore space. And I'll quote from the article because I got it up right here. With apologies to Dwight Eisenhower, the cost of one modern space shuttle is this. 1.5 million lives lost for want of anti-malarial bed nets. It is electricity to power a U.S. city of 2 million people for a year. It is 900 billion gallons of fresh drinking water produced by desalinization. We pay for a single shuttle launch with 50 million bushels of wheat. We house a handful of men in space with a year's worth of housing far more than 10 million U.S. citizens. NASA is not just spending money, it is spending the sweat of our laborers, the genius of our scientists, and the hope of our children. I mean, you think, it just takes the breath away. It's like something from the early 70s, a speech by Walter Mondale or somebody.
So,
one of the people who wanted to end spaceflight 30-odd years ago.
So,
I had thought that this sort of thing was really on the dustbin of history, but I guess not.
So he's really saying that this program is really, thank God, an end to funding space, which is a waste of money.
I think that, and this may be my cynical side showing, President Obama can't outright end human spaceflight, at least publicly funded human spaceflight, because it does have a certain cachet and popularity with the American people, and even more so for various reasons, some of them perhaps not so nice in Congress. So he's doing it kind of sneakily, that he's ending Constellation because, you know, it's behind schedule and over budget, you know, as if that was ever any reason to end a government program. I mean, President Obama is not shy of spending money on things that he likes, you know, even if they're not very useful. But anyway, but instead we're going to do space exploration smarter. In the first iteration of his space proposal, it was to do all this technology that one day it would be useful to do space exploration. The problem was, there was no metrics involved in this. There was nothing that you could bring to a president of the United States sometime in the future and said, okay, we've done all this technology thing. We're now ready to go into space if you'll give the word, and if Congress will pay for it. So it was just kind of a lot of directionless stuff. President Obama has kind of recognized that, okay, this is kind of a problem selling the idea. All right, we're going to you know, we got now destinations to go places. An asteroid in 2025, Mars orbit in 2035, Mars itself sometime. And, oh, by the way, we're not going back to the moon because we've already been there. Of course, I would say, who's this we, Mr. President?
But you know, in defense, and I mean, that's what I get to do is be the devil's advocate and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, under the vision for space exploration, you know, the target to get back to the moon is slipping and slipping and slipping. The target to go to Mars was already 2030 or later. I mean, you know, people were kind of laughing at that. So, you know, are we any different? Sure, we had deadlines. But, you know, they were slipped and moved all the time. What's the difference between, you know, that and what the president said the other day when he's saying, you know, Mars around 2030, 2035? That's no different than what was slipping with the VSE.
Well, I think on his schedule, Mars is more like 2045 or maybe even 2050. You have a point, is that we've set deadlines and then we just kind of fail to meet them. Unlike with Apollo, you know, because Kennedy set the end of the decade deadline, and it was a race with the Russians, and then Kennedy died, and it was his legacy, and we had to do this, and Johnson, you know, had the umph to make sure that it happened. We need to figure out a way to meet what we say we're going to do. I guess maybe it might be kind of a backhanded virtue for the Obama space program, is that he's not even pretending that he's going to be doing anything. He's just kind of throughout these years because, well, they're far enough in the future that we don't really have to pay for stuff right now. And if they go away, well, you know, unforeseen circumstances, sorry, so sad, or maybe he's not even in office anymore so he can blame, so somebody else can get blamed for it. At least with Constellation, we were actually starting to build stuff and do design work. And even though it was inadequately funded, a lot of things were happening up front. It wasn't, well, this is something we're going to do sometime in the far future.
Absolutely. You have a caller. Caller, are you still with us, please?
Yes.
And you are?
I'm John, Atlanta.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to the last discussion. Reminded me of something I said about a month ago on the show about the objective here to let the thing just slowly die, basically. You know? But, I agree exactly with the caller. We're not. I think the real ultimate blunder in a way was, in fact, the whole plan to retire the shuttle, if you really go back there, because that's opened this whole thing up to this possibility, you know? And if really what we probably should have done is built the next generation of orbiters in a way. I kind of think that if we go back to 2003, instead we let this Columbia thing, you know, turn us into giving up on the shuttle because somehow it was way too unsafe or something, you know.
Well, it didn't happen. Mark, any comments to you about
well,
that?
Well, okay. There were some good rationales for ending the shuttle. I mean, it wasn't just because of Columbia. By this year, 2010, in order to continue the space shuttle program, we would have had to recertify the orbiters because launching them into space and bringing them home brings a lot of wear and tear. So they would have to have been refurbished quite a bit at quite a big expense. I'm in general agreement with people who think that commercial space travel is the way to go, at least for now, from Earth to low Earth orbit. Deep space exploration, I don't think you can go commercial right now. Maybe with commercial partnerships. You know, that's something that I'm certainly in favor of. But continuing the shuttle would just put off the day that we could go commercial. And also ending the shuttle, in theory at least, freed up a lot of money to go into the commercial space thing, into doing proper space exploration. I mean, yeah, you're quite right. We're kind of stuck with that decision. You know, if we had been able to find a way to extend the shuttle another 5 years and ramp up commercial space and do space exploration and do the other things, once again, it's always a question of money. How much do you want to pay for it?
Yeah. The reason why something like the SpaceX effort couldn't have gone in parallel with the shuttle staying on. I mean, that's relatively low budget if we hadn't been trying Constellation at the same time. In other words, the whole idea that I mean, you know, I think we committed ourselves to a program that, nobody's willing to fund, even back in mid, 2003, 2004, 2005 period, and then essentially opens up the possibility, like all programs go over budget and get delayed, we end the shuttle by a date certain, and we don't have a replacement, and that makes it very easy for someone like Obama to come in and just let the whole thing go away, and the expertise goes away along with it, like you're saying, those people get laid off, and... You know, that's just kind of my viewpoint. That, and the shuttle, you know, has like about a $3 billion fixed cost, I understand, from some of the people that
basically
comment
people
on this.
Basically people and materials and so on, and just keeping the lights on.
Right. And so basically the marginal cost above that to fly missions isn't really all that high. It's just that, you know, we have, well, we only have three orbiters now, and maybe not enough missions being flown on the shuttle. But the shuttle has, I mean... I don't see any other vehicle coming along that's going to rival that capability. I mean, in any of the time frames we've been talking about here, you know, unless there's a really new commitment to space, you know?
Yeah, the shuttle is what it is. It's inadequate for a lot of things. It didn't really fulfill the promise that was given to it when it was first proposed in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But it does fly. And 30 years of experience has taught us quite a bit of how to fly it. But it is also a case for moving on.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're not moving on quite as effectively and as quickly as we should.
That's true. I agree. There are other options, and you know, I mean, I guess we'll see how Obama's heavy lift vehicle is going to be supposedly committed to by 2015 turns out, but.
I have my doubts on that. Of course, it's entirely possible that Congress will insist that we start building a heavy lifter this year or next year.
Yeah, but why?
And it won't be, you know, if all this... I mean, he's talking about building a liquid oxygen kerosene engine. That sounds to me like the F1 that powered the Saturn V. I mean, why build a completely new engine? Let's just get an F1... refurbish it with new materials and new control systems and whatnot. I mean, the F1, of course, used vacuum tubes as controllers, I understand. So you can refurbish that and not try to reinvent the wheel.
Well, yeah, I think that part of it was they were trying to duplicate this Russian engine on the RS-180. I forget what it is. It's a Russian-built engine they use on the Atlas V.
Yeah.
And they are upset because we can't actually make the engine ourselves right now. And they wanted us to get the indigenous capability to make our own equivalent to that, I thought. And maybe use multiple engines, like five of them or so, on a heavy lift first stage.
Well, the Saturn V had five F1s clustered in the first stage. So, you know, that's not really outside the realm of possibility. Mm-hmm. Of course, the more engines you cluster, it's the principle of keep it simple, stupid. The more... engines you have to fail. The Russian lunar launcher had that problem. I think they had 10 or more engines in their first stage, and they kept blowing up.
Yeah. Yep. The inland. Yeah. Well, that's the idea there. That's the kind of thing I think they're talking about. But well, only thing I could see that would be equivalent, you know, as an alternative shuttle would be if you could make this rocket a reusable rocket in some way, recover these stages safely.
Well, they used to recover the SRBs, but it turned out to be more expensive, actually, than rebuilding them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they were dumped in the ocean, and you had to send out boats to pick them up, and then they had to be refurbished and whatnot. And it turned out that particularly in the flight rate that we finally kind of arrived at, 4, 5, 6 a year,
mm-hmm.
it just wasn't cost effective.
Right.
Now, there have been schemes, for instance, to do a liquid fuel flyback booster in place of the SRBs. The idea is that, and these, in fact, would be refurbished F1s, and they would boost the space shuttle the way the SRBs do, and then they would be designed to basically fly back to the Kennedy Space Center. Never really go off the ground. Interesting technical idea. No money for it. And plus, you know, the space shuttle program's kind of bending anyway, so...
Yeah, why do it?
Yeah.
John, anything else? Otherwise, I'll move on.
Yeah, okay. I'll talk to you some other time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, John.
Bye-bye.
Karen in Denver, Colorado, has a blistering email for us both. And Karen says, guys, come on. What are you talking about? This show is about technology, engines, all sorts of crap. Okay, here's the bottom line. The country's in dire economic straits. There's no jobs in the private sector. There's no reason for anybody to think that spending any money when all this community can do is talk about rocket engines and this and that and going to Mars maybe in 30 years or whatever is relevant to anything. Tell us how anything that is spent on space is going to employ anyone in my family. Tell me how it's going to do anything for me or for anyone I know. What's in it for the American citizen to see our tax money, whether it's 0.5% or 1% or 1.5% of the national budget spent on this? What's in it for us? Can you address that? Why should we give a bloody damn about any of this? I don't care about an engine. I put emphasis in her email because I've been sitting here on it for 10 minutes.
Okay, I can understand, you know, talking about this type of engine or that type of engine is kind of inside baseball.
By the way, she would not be listening to this show unless she at least had enough space knowledge to know the damn show existed, right? I mean, so this can't be a couch potato.
Let's just address her question.
Okay.
A national civilian space program, at least properly done the way I would want it, would enhance the country's national security, its economic vitality, and expand scientific knowledge. Now, I don't know this lady's family or whether, you know, anybody in her family has any interest in being employed in the space program or in any industry that supports the space program. I can't really address that question. Kind of like the same thing as the exploration of the Americas back hundreds of years ago. You know, you could ask, for instance, Prince Henry the Navigator, guy people generally do not know about because everybody thinks about Columbus as the real first big explorer. Prince Henry the Navigator, back about 100 years before Columbus, ran for the Kingdom of Portugal, what you might consider an ocean-going version of NASA. His goal, and he had a goal, was to find an ocean route around Africa to the East Indies. It would bypass the Muslim countries that stood between Europe and the spice markets of the East Indies. And what he did was is that he actually designed and built and tested the art of ocean travel. This made Portugal a very rich, very prosperous power for a while. Eventually, other countries picked up on it. The one thing to say interesting about Prince Henry the Navigator and Columbus is that Columbus, you know, speaking about off-the-shelf commercial vehicles, acquired, you know, he did not have to build ocean-going vehicles himself. He could just lease them from private industry or from the Spanish government. So the idea is that a civilian space program builds a lot of technology. Let me give you, I mean, a lot of it, of course, is forward-thinking, so, you know, you can argue about it. But let me give you a couple of examples for the moon. The moon has permeated in its soil a substance called helium-3. It's an isotope that does not exist in nature on Earth. There are a lot of engineers who think that helium-3 would provide the basis for clean, limitless energy using fusion power. I'll refer you to the University of Wisconsin's Fusion Energy Institute that's run by a guy named Dr. Greg Kaczynski. Harrison Schmitt, one of the last men to walk on the moon, and himself a lunar geologist, is associated with these people. A space shuttle full of helium-3 would—I'm not remembering the right figures—but I think it would power the entire energy needs of this country for quite a long time, and it would do it cleanly. I mean, with one of the problems, you know, with fusion energy is that it shoots out neutrinos, which eventually irradiates your fusion reactor, and you have to bring it offline to clean that stuff up. Helium-3 reactions doesn't have that problem to that extent. Solar energy. There's a concept that was developed in the late 60s and has been popularized in various forms ever since to use space-based solar collectors beyond the Earth's atmosphere that would gather sunlight and then beam the energy to collectors on Earth. Again, virtually limitless clean energy. Yeah, you know, without the fossil fuels that, you know, people get kind of head up about. And materials for building such things can be found on the moon. In fact, there's this guy who works at the University of Houston in Clear Lake named Dr. David Criswell. I'm sure, David, you know of him.
Yeah, he's been on the show many times.
Yeah, who has an idea of building these solar collectors on the lunar surface and beaming the energy directly from the moon to the Earth.
Well, China will have to do that. We're not going to the moon.
Well, yeah, you see, that's the thing. That kind of torques me with, you know, people who are saying, well, you know, China's not going to the moon anytime soon, and even if they did, what of it? You know, I really think the moon has the potential of being the Persian Gulf of the later 21st century, and if we work it right, it won't have a lot of bad-tempered Muslims living there. I mean, the potential for space exploration properly conducted to enrich people and, you know, enrich our lives is kind of as limitless as your imagination. I'm sure that there are other people who have other ideas. I mean, that's entire books have been written on this. So, you know, that's kind of my take on it right now, just off the top of my head.
Well, I could say some things, but you've got another caller on hold, and I'll hold off on my comments, and you've got an IM listener waiting too. But let's see who's on hold with us. Are you there, please, listener? Hello, on the toll free line. Are you there? Is anyone there on the toll free line? Going once, twice? Did you hang up? Hello.
I guess the connection got broken.
Well, yeah, but I should have that crazy hang up noise. Last time, are you there? All right, I hung up. Call back. If you're the toll-free caller, please call back. Dr. Jurist in Montana has a couple of comments. One is, remember, regarding the Denver comment, most economic studies have shown a positive return on investment dollars spent in the space program. Yes, we've talked about a lot of that on the air. We can talk about that more in a little while. And then his question is regarding SRB reusability concept being extended to a reusable liquid. My guess is that refurbishing a liquid after it swims in the ocean would be a lot more extensive than refurbishing a solid.
Okay, well, on that subject, the concept that I was talking about envisioned the liquid fuel booster actually landing on land back at the Kennedy Space Center, not splashing down. You know, so it wouldn't be exposed to all the salt water and such.
Okay.
And the economic study, at least one of them that he's referring to, was the famous Chase econometric study done back in the 70s examining the Apollo program that concluded that, you know, for every dollar that NASA spent, eventually $7 winds up back in the general economy. Now, you know, there are economic analysts who dispute that, and some of my libertarian friends are saying, yeah, but if it was kept in the private sector to begin with, it would have generated even more money. So you can argue back and forth, but at least it's a good talking point, excuse me, when, you know, people ask about why we're spending all that money. You know, it's not like we're shooting it into space or spending it on the Department of HUD or on dubious stimulus projects. Excuse me again.
Do you think that, I'll just be blunt. What we're talking about in terms of returns, and I think the president even referenced all of this, shouldn't this be a factor in in administration space policy, and why does it seem to not be?
Well, as far as the current president goes, I don't really think he understands much about economics and about the way business is run. Private business for him is something that's either co-opted or used as a whipping boy. You know, he talks about, you know, greedy bankers and Wall Street people and whatnot, and he's basically taken over General Motors and you know, he may, and all this and the other thing. He doesn't understand how the private sector is a generator and a creator of wealth, and how technology development, you know, even if it's done under government auspices, helps to fuel that, and how expanding a frontier, I mean, not just with tiny one-shot missions. I call Obama's little thing about going to an asteroid and so on, deep space Apollo. You know, Apollo is kind of maligned because, you know, we went to the moon, planted the flag, walked around, gathered some soil samples, and then returned. There was no permanent infrastructure built up. Obama Space 3.0 does not build up any permanent infrastructure. It's just, I think Paul Spoudis, another guy, you know, called it bread and circuses in space.
Right, I saw that article.
Yeah, it's great. You know, basically people will go, ooh, there's a guy on an asteroid. Of course, you know, landing on an asteroid may be a little more difficult than can be imagined because some of those near-Earth approaches tend to tumble quite a bit.
Hey, Bruce Willis did it.
Hey, if Bruce Willis can do it, you know, all things considered, anybody can do it.
And they,
mean, you know, Ben Affleck.
That's right. And they had the Russian solution to fixing technical problems. Remember that solution?
Yeah, bang it with a hammer.
That's,
I mean,
right.
I've used that.
And
crew
disciplined a 9mm handgun, or was it a 45? I loved it.
Well,
that keeps the crew
thing
in shape.
The Armageddon is it was fun, but it was one of these things in which the laws of physics changed in order to facilitate the plot.
Hey, I hear that all the time in new space. What's new?
You
just described
the big thing hitting the Earth movie goes, I prefer Deep Impact.
You've just described a big part of the space cadet world.
Well, yeah, I mean, they tend to a lot of people tend to de-emphasize the problems of rocket science when a commercial space company does it, because they tend to confuse commercial with magic. I mean, commercial space has its advantages, doesn't have a lot of bureaucracy and rules and stuff, and it's kind of focused on the bottom line and doesn't waste as much money. But then, of course, it's more likely to fail, too, because, you know, if the people running it don't really have a real good plan to fulfilling a market need.
Let me go to our caller. We have our caller back. And by the way, John in Montana points out that Bruce Willis did die on the asteroid. So.
Yes, he did. Very heroically, too.
Caller, are you there now, caller?
Yes, I am. I'm right here.
And you are, please?
Ernie.
I thought
Houston, but now from California.
I thought it might be Bruce Willis calling, so.
put down the hammer.
What are you doing in California? Why would anyone move to this state in this day and age?
Oh, I got laid off from Boeing in Houston, and I came down to see my family and went to go look for some jobs over here in person to Scorpius and JPL, and got to go around and see my friends and continue looking for work here.
Good luck to you. What's on your mind for Mark?
Well, I think it's a good idea to have for the space cadet community to be part of shaping space policy, even whether you're a Democrat or Republican, or we just had our convention over here just the other day. We got Nancy in town.
Who is we?
The Democrats.
Okay.
Yeah, and basically to step on in there and make sure that these people know that the Democrat Party ought to have a good space policy. Consider the business aspects of it, speak well to it, educate everybody around you, because, you know, just being part of the space community and not speaking up is you're just talking to the crowd, to the same choir. And so, for me to hear that there's some Democrat out there who's just totally anti-space. It's just kind of like scratching on the chalkboard, and it's not helpful. You know, we really got to get, you know, everything that is in all those good demand for quality, the things that are make life better, happen because, you know, people got smarter. We went to, you know, the Apollo program basically created all that. And basically, I just wanted to use this time here as a platform to say, get out there, be active, and participate.
Well said. Any thoughts on that, Mark?
I think the caller makes some good points that one of the other big problems with the space community is that we kind of like to talk and yell and scream and argue with ourselves, and you know, we don't talk to other people about this sort of thing. And about various benefits and issues and whatnot. You know, he's talking about Democrats and such. Fortunately, support for space is kind of bipartisan in Congress, and I understand a lot of it is jobs in the district and whatnot, and, you know, hopefully there's a little bit of division there, too. Yes, you know, somebody representing a space district, you know, has to pay attention to the space program, but you should also think that somebody would get elected in a space district who has a genuine feeling for the thing. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned, of course, the ignorance of space in the general public, and, you know, I couldn't agree more. You know, one of the big problems is that there's been some polling data that has people exaggerating in their own minds what the real cost of the public space program is. You know, they imagine, well, they're doing all this stuff. It's going to cost, you know, at least $100 billion a year. And then, you know, they get shocked, you know, when it's, no, it's really about 18 a year.
Right. Yeah, it's important that people get more and more educated. I was just watching on C-SPAN and listening to Gene Kranz give his, they aired an interview that he had about 1999 or so, and it was so eerie how he had his finger right on the issues of today with an interview 10 years ago. So, it's important, and I thank you guys for giving me the time on the air to share with you guys.
Thanks a lot, Ernie.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And listeners, Ernie, I mean, what he's saying is really important. Regardless of your party affiliation in politics, assuming you have one, you should go to conferences and conventions and find a way to express your views on why space is important. Space has always been pretty much a bipartisan thing. Both parties understand that this is extremely important and valuable for America and for our future as well as for the world. So it is not up to one party or the other, and it is up to all of us to express our views however we politically believe. And if you don't do that, and you don't like the way the space program turns out, you know what? It's your damn fault. So if you care about something, go express your views, even if you think they're not listening to you. I mean, that's all I can say. And they probably won't listen to you, but go do it anyway.
Well, they won't listen to you if you don't say anything.
Well, look, they didn't listen to 70% of the people with health care. So
I think that's going to bite them in November.
Well, maybe, but I mean, I can understand that experience really driving people away from something like space, where, you know, probably members of Congress maybe get one out of 10,000, you know, comments from their constituents on space. They don't get very much. I mean, I was shut off on talking health care to my two senators as well as my representative. Very, very frustrating, since I have so much health care experience with my son and my mom. And it was very frustrating. Why would I want to go talk to Lynn Woolsey ever again, except, you know, she is my congressional representative. So I understand getting frustrated and not wanting to do it. But then you don't have any grounds to complain if you don't like the way the programs turn out. I don't know what else to say about it. It's a tough deal when your representatives don't listen to you. Here's a comment from Marshall, again, in Big D. the Russians, Europe, Japan, China, and even India have a space program. If space is such a bad investment, why are these countries wasting their money on space?
Well, beats me, but, you know, your libertarian-type fellow will say, well, these are all governments, and governments just like to waste money. But my answer is that they're doing space because they recognize that being any kind of power of any kind of influence on this planet means you have to be spacefaring. The Chinese certainly recognize it. You know, that's why they have the third publicly funded manned space program. And I suspect, particularly if and when commercial space gets off the ground, a lot of small countries are going to buy their own space program off cheap by leasing rights off of commercial space programs. It's not exactly a private market, but it's an alternative to the American government market. You know, a country like, say, Brazil or South Korea, you know, who can't build their own indigenous space program, say that the SpaceX Dragon is going up and down and doing things, they can buy flights on it, do experiments and stuff. And
well, absolutely. What do they know that we may not know, or our listener in Denver may not know? That, you know, the real truth is that the federal government spends money on a lot of different things. And some of what it spends money on builds wealth for the nation and for its people and is an investment in our future. And some of what it spends money on hasn't got anything to do with building wealth for the nation. And space development is a wealth builder for the nation. It's an investment into our future. Building something like Hoover Dam was an absolute investment into our future and helped us win World War II and has transformed the American Southwest, and is worth, you know, billion times more than what it cost to build the dam. On the other hand, the government gives away entitlements and does things like a school breakfast program, or, you know, puts people to work doing this and that and the other. And that money circulates through the economy as well and has a multiplier. But it's very, very different than doing things that you know, create infrastructure, build jobs, do things like the interstate highway system, which has opened up all sorts of opportunities for Americans in disciplines and fields that we never dreamed of back when Eisenhower did it. So space is in that category, and I contend that if we really industrialize space, in 10 years we would not recognize it. We would not even have a clue the kinds of commercial opportunities, jobs, and new investment opportunities we're developing. Once you put it in the hands of entrepreneurs and people who, you know, have a creative business idea and can raise the capital for it, it gets transformed really, really quickly. Government can't do that transformation. All it can do is enable the opportunities to take root. And that's what we need from government with space.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm, you know, not against government space, obviously. I'm certainly a supporter of commercial space, but ways can be found to create a symbiosis. You know, government being a core market, for instance, and enabling technology and doing a lot of the cutting-edge exploration in science and technology. Commercial space taking over routine things like going to low Earth orbit, space manufacturing, eventually lunar mining.
Well, lots.
I mean, the possibilities are just endless if we just have the will to grasp them.
By the way, as John points out from Montana, the lady who sent in that note on Instant Messenger, Boniva, which is the osteoporosis drug, that family of drugs got its initial research in the space community. In fact, John was one of the original people working on that kind of research, and you know, maybe you would have had that drug and those improvements through regular commercial opportunities. There's no way of knowing if it would have happened sooner or later or better or worse. I suspect it would have probably been developed, but space has definitely enhanced it and brought it to market and made it possible, as well as many other medical and telemedical kinds of things. So, you know, you may not see how space is impacting your life, but trust me, if space were denied us on a commercial basis right now, your life would hit the tank pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, you know, speaking of drugs, for instance, apparently the first drug to actually be developed in space, apparently something that can alleviate the symptoms of salmonella, is being developed on the International Space Station. You know, the thing is, we spent a whole lot of money and time building this thing, but right now, this decade, it's finally kind of coming into its own with its six-person crew, you know, with some time and effort being used to actually do the research instead of building and maintaining the thing, which is what we've been doing. Believe me, I've had my criticisms about how the space station was built. It's kind of a case study on how not to do stuff, but it's here now. And it can be used, and I don't know if the benefits that will come from it will entirely, you know, pay for all the headaches and the treasure we spent building it. But at the very least, we now know some of the pros and cons and you know, so that the next time we can do things better. Certainly Bigelow has learned some things. Its inflatable space station concept used to be a concept called Transhab that was looked at as an enhancement to the space station in the 90s. And it basically bought the license to build it from NASA. Again, another example of symbiosis between the public and the private.
Well, and don't forget GPS, but I mean, we could go through the list, you know, for the balance of the show. But listeners, we are coming up toward the end of a two-hour program. So again, let me put out the toll-free number and encourage those of you that are listening, if you do want to get in on the act here, your time is limited. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Mark, if you were to write an article and say, this is where I recommend we go and how we do it, what would you say?
Well, I would, just in a nutshell, I would focus on the moon right now. It's our closest neighbor. It has a lot of things there that are useful, like the water, like the helium-3, like other things. I mean, the discoveries we made just from robotic space probes last year have revealed that the moon is not quite what we thought it was. And there's lots of things there to explore and to see if we can exploit. As far as the commercial stuff goes, I'll reiterate, we need to do policies like tax breaks and such to encourage private markets. You know, contracting out, you know, to commercial space vendors, government travel to and from the space station is good. I have advocated that for over a decade, but it's inadequate the way it goes. And finally, I would reiterate particularly to our members of Congress, if you're going to suggest start a space effort, you got to pay for it. We can't say that, you know, determine that going back to the moon or whatever is going to cost X, and then later on find that inconvenient. So, well, okay, it costs X minus Y because, you know, we've got the war or Katrina or the budget deficit. We need to pay for it. Now, there are ways, of course, to ameliorate that. We can do international partnerships, or what I prefer, maybe some commercial partnerships. Entire books could be written about how that could be done. Maybe I'll do that sometime.
You have a book that you want to tell us about, too, right?
Okay. First of all, for people who haven't heard my previous appearances of the show, I'm the author of an alternate history novel named Children of Apollo, which is set in an alternate universe in which the Apollo program continued past the point where it proceeded in our universe. It goes up to Apollo 23 and involves a space adventure with the first female astronaut in that universe. My newest published effort, which is right now solely available for the Amazon Kindle, is called The Last Moonwalker and Other Stories. The Last Moonwalker is a short novel I wrote from a film script that I wrote several years ago, which is about the next lunar mission, which at the time, of course, I imagine it being kind of the constellation thing at the end of this decade, through the eyes of a fictional last surviving Apollo astronaut. Yeah, he's asked to kind of come out of retirement and do some public relations and, you know, give the new crew pointers about what it's like to be on another world. And he kind of wrestles with his own legacy and why has it been 40-plus years since, you know, his flight and so on. And the same book has a couple of short stories based in the Children of Apollo universe. One is called The First Woman on the Moon, which is about one of the characters in Children of Apollo. Another one is called Two Old Men, which is about Ronald Reagan and Bill Proxmire. In our universe, both men died of Alzheimer's. In the alternate universe, a treatment for Alzheimer's has been developed because of enhanced space technology. It's not a cure, but it's used. And Proxmire, of course, who has opposed, you know, space spending, you know, from his early days in the Senate, is in a quandary. You know, does he admit that he, you know, was wrong about everything he ever believed in and takes the treatment, or does he remain stubborn and, you know, dies a slow, horrible death of Alzheimer's, and he goes to President Reagan for advice. And finally what they do is they cut a public service announcement together, you know, awareness of Alzheimer's. There is no cure, but there is a treatment. You know, get tested and so on and so forth. So that's that story. And then the other space-related story in that particular volume is the story of the first Apollo moon landing from the point of view of an alien visitor. So anyway, it's available on the Amazon Kindle. It's there. It's fairly inexpensive to download. I invite everybody within the sound of my voice to check it out, see what you think.
Will it be available as a regular book or only as the Kindle version?
Right now, only as a Kindle. We might be bringing it out as a Dead Tree book at some point. But right now, I'm finding that e-book versions of my work is far outselling the Dead Tree versions. Plus, putting them out on the Kindle is relatively easier than sending them up Dead Tree.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, it just doesn't have anything to do with your book or space. But if you put it on the Kindle, you can't. It's not the same format for the Microsoft Reader or the Barnes & Noble Reader. So everything is a different format?
Yeah. But you can download Kindle software to your BlackBerry, to your personal computer, and I think one version of the Apple iPod.
So what would be involved if you wanted your ebook to be on the Barnes & Noble Reader as well?
I'm not sure. I've been exploring that. Personally, I don't think the Nook is going anywhere, but I've been exploring that possibility.
Is the Microsoft Reader going anywhere, or is it all Kindle and Kindle and Kindle?
I think Kindle's kind of it for right now. The Apple iPad may prove to be some competition, and I'm certainly looking at that as well.
But everything's a different format. They didn't make it so that one format fits all that would benefit we, the consumers.
No.
Or you, the author.
Against one another. And a lot of publishers will put out all the different formats.
See, it would benefit you, the author, if you could get it on all the formats, too.
Yeah. But then again, you know, if you know, the Kindle, of course, is the biggest selling item. They're selling lots of e-books through the Kindle. There may be just a cost-benefit problem. But I am exploring particularly either the Nook or the iPad.
Okay, just clarifying things up. We're sort of near the end of the show, or we should be for a two-hour program. If people want to get a hold of you, and what's also the best address to get to your postings and your blog?
Okay. My blog is at Curmudgeon's Corner. It's http://curmudgeons.blogspot.com. And I basically post links to just about everything I write for associated content in the Houston Examiner there, plus a whole lot of other stuff. You can go to the Houston Examiner, and let me get the exact address for that. It's basically a lot of Houston-specific space stories. I do my more national space and international space stories on associated content, and it is coming. Okay, it's basically examiner.com, and then Houston. You just look for Houston space. Google Houston. Houston Space News Examiner. And then associated content is associatedcontent.com. And
now, is that yours too, or
well, associated content is a big gigantic internet content company. And you can just Google associated content and my name, Mark Whittington, and that should take you to my page on that particular platform.
But everything there is also on Curmudgeon's Corner.
Yeah. I link everything from Curmudgeon's Corner. I'm also on Facebook. If you want to friend me there, I mean, there's all sorts of ways to contact me on the internet.
Do you give out an email address?
You can give out my email address.
The one that I've been using?
Yes.
Okay. John has the last question from Montana. And do you actually know, John, that the shuttle is coming in over a weird path tomorrow morning and goes over some northern part of Montana? Don't know if you can see it from Billings, but if you're interested, you might want to check out their path. It comes down over Montana into South Dakota and makes sort of a crazy route into Florida. So it may be too far north from Billings, I don't know, but if you haven't checked it out, check it out. Okay, here's his question. This is a fun way to end the show today. Mark, why do you like to tweak the space cadets so thoroughly? Admittedly, it is great fun.
Well, they are very kind. A lot of people, and not all of them, I mean, I shouldn't put a broad brush in what I call the Internet Rocketeer Club. Well, more recently, I sometimes call them Obama Zombies in Space.
Wait a minute.
It sounds like the title of a bad horror movie. But a lot of them are very sure of themselves, and they're kind of, they just kind of need challenging. Everybody needs challenging. I need challenging. I don't mind being challenged if it's in a respectful way, of course. You know, if it's in a disrespectful way, I'm not going to react very well to that. But people need to have their assumptions challenged. And a lot of these people talk to each other and they validate each other's opinions without challenging each other. And then some of their opinions are pretty weird, if you ask me, and inconsistent. And I particularly like the people who argue over space architecture. You know, they all hate the constellation, but everybody has their own particular favorite architecture. You know, some people like the EELV, some people like EELV Enhanced, some people like the direct thing, and they kind of fall upon each other and snipe and yell and scream and argue and insult as well. But, you know, I kind of, you know, am bothered by the idea of space activism as being kind of this bubble where everybody just talks to each other and they don't listen. That's a large part of what one should do, is not only talk, but listen. You might get an insight that you haven't even thought about before if you listen to some other. Even if a lot of the stuff some other person says you think is bunk, still listen. You know, there is a principle, in fact, in management, that if you have a big project, listen to the critics. 90% of them, of what they say may be bunk, but they are very motivated to find the flaws in your idea. And if you let them do your work for them, then you can fix your idea using their work, even though their idea is to destroy your idea and not make it better. A lot of people just don't recognize that. They just say if you disagree with them, you're stupid, you're dumb, you're you know, a fraud, you're whatever, you know, insult comes into their minds.
So you're tweaking the space cadets in a friendly, positive way of using the word space cadets, of which I claim to be one, is really for our own benefit.
Well, plus the fact I do kind of...
Isn't that what the president says? Healthcare is for our own benefit, and on and on and on?
Well, yeah.
See, I'm just tweaking you back.
Sure. I mean, you know, I will admit that I kind of get kind of a buzz, you know, saying so-and-so, I'm, you know, this is silly, you know, here's the flaws in your argument, and, you know, calling them things like the Internet Rocketeer Club, you know, which a lot of them, you know, kind of don't really have a sense of humor, particularly about themselves, and they'll just go berserk instead of, you know, okay, right, and maybe just going on. I mean, it may be for other people's benefit. It's for my benefit, too. I admit it.
Of course, the Internet Rocketeer Club produces PowerPoint rockets, which really, you know, always work flawlessly.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of PowerPoint rockets or ViewGraph rockets is that, you know, if you don't actually build them. Now, I have the greatest of respect for people who actually build hardware and test them. The SpaceXs, the Maston Space Systems, Armadillo, you know, a lot of them are too busy to bloviate on the Internet. They're actually doing stuff.
Speaking of bloviating, and I know we're over the period, but when the president gave his speech, and before, I've been listening to the national news on television and the cable shows, and I hear the anchors talking about space. They are so woefully ignorant across the channels, it doesn't make a difference which one you listen to, about anything real about space or what it's about. You just have to wonder if we know about space and know that they're ignorant and making really stupid comments, what about the things they're reporting and talking about that we don't have as much hands-on knowledge about?
Well, sure. I mean, and some networks are worse in that regard than others. You have to take anything you hear on the radio or television or on the Internet with a grain of salt.
Except for the space show listeners.
Well, obviously, space show listeners are very knowledgeable and adroit and can certainly separate the wheat from the chaff. I mean, that's a given.
Yeah, or they wouldn't be here. That's true.
Yeah.
Mark, I've held you way over, and I appreciate your being here. Marshall signed off, and he said, make sure you have him back on soon. So I hope you will return to the space show.
Oh, anytime you like.
And any pearls of wisdom, closing comments, what would you like to leave all of us cadets with today?
Well, as far as the mess our space effort is in, you know, persevere. Believe me, a couple of hundred years from now, you know, if we work hard enough and things turn out right, it'll be something that only people who write history books will worry about. In other words, this too will pass. You know, don't let things get you down. Consider these problems more of a challenge than anything else. No matter, you know, what your particular vision is, and also, always remember that space is something that's wonderful, that is something that should inspire awe and joy. A lot of people, you know, get very angry and very irate and very unhappy when they talk space to each other because they you know, I guess it's just kind of that rancor. Just occasionally step back and thinking, we're living in an era where people actually fly beyond the atmosphere of the Earth, where there are six American flags on the moon. You know, a friend of mine once said, if you feel the need to say this Pledge of Allegiance and there's no flag available, look up at the moon. There's six of them up there.
For the time being.
For the time being, you know.
They'll soon be in the Peking National Museum.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a possibility.
Oh, that's not how we should end the show.
No, it's a downer, but think of that also as a challenge.
Absolutely, and we will do this a lot sooner than the 3 or 4 years since you were on before.
Oh, the time just passes by.
That's right, and one must wonder if we're any further along in becoming truly spacefaring. But
well, we're learning things. We're learning through mistakes, is what I like to say. Somebody once said that the American people will always do the right thing after they have exhausted all the wrong things.
That is a good way of saying it. That's a great way to close the show. We'll always do the right thing after we've exhausted all the wrong things. Let's hope that path for space is a very, very short path for exhausting all the wrong things.
Yeah, I'm not getting any younger. I would like to at least see the next person to walk on the moon before I pass on.
Well, remember, space in an urn is always an option for those of us getting older.
That's true. I've often thought that maybe I should, as part of my last will and testament, that the first person in my family to go to the moon must take my ashes there. Even if it's, you know, my great-great-great-great-grandson or something.
Maybe they'll launch you there on a rail gun someday that a lot of people want to build.
No. You have to physically go there and pour the ashes onto the lunar regolith. None of this launching on a rail gun thing.
Okay. That's the challenge out there for the would-be entrepreneurs that will want to go to the moon. Actually, maybe a Google Lunar XPRIZE contestant, you know, the ashes don't weigh that much. Hurry up and become ashes so, you know, you can enter into that contest.
I'd rather watch. I'd rather even be there. Be the person pouring the ashes. I mean, I'm aware of the idea of wanting good things to happen after I'm gone. I also would like to see some good things while I'm still here.
Absolutely. Like, I want to see us go to Mars. And
Mars, too.
Well, I still know what Mars is.
With medical science being what it is, maybe we'll still make it.
Absolutely. Mark, thank you again for being a guest on the show. And tomorrow, listeners, we're talking to one guy, Mark Millis, who actually works in Breakthrough Propulsion, that might be able to find ways to take us to Mars and even do deeper space travel with things that are not yet in our consciousness. So you don't want to miss that show, 2 p.m. California time. He used to run NASA's Office of Breakthrough Propulsion until, in the infinite wisdom of NASA, that division was canceled. So Mark Millis tomorrow on the Space Show. Thanks again, Mark, and we will be in touch soon.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And listeners, thank you for tuning in today. Goodbye from the Space Show.